So as I observe the nation's food chain over the past, 727 Saturdays, it seems to me as though the government's attempt to prohibit farmer-to-consumer interactions is increasing every year. And that I guess that's why I wanted to pick up Farmer Dan's story in Washington, D.C. In your observations, does it appear that the government is intensifying its effort to prohibit farmer-to-consumer interactions and commerce?
That's a tough one because, you know, the USDA has a program called Know Your Farmer. And, you know, I think they've been pretty sincere about that program.
What about the FDA?
Well, you know, and that's the part. I mean, the FDA is a separate agency. And I don't think the FDA has any respect for the idea of knowing your food, knowing your farmer. The FDA is inclined toward what I would call a sanitary model. They would rather just sanitize all the food, irradiate it all, or otherwise put it through processes that strip out any possibility of pathogens. And in the process, though, they strip out the good bacteria and the good enzymes as well. And that's kind of their goal, their model. And so this whole, you know, buy local and raw milk and pastured chicken and...
A giant pain in the butt, right?
Well, it's not only a pain in the butt, but it's a food safety threat. And so they you know, and people who buy from Farmer Dan often, you know, they don't not only want their eggs from Farmer Dan, but they don't want them washed. They don't want them refrigerated. They want them, as you suggest, they want them the old-fashioned way.
Yeah.
And so that just totally runs against anything the FDA can even talk about. I mean, it makes them apoplectic. Because they really, I think, believe very sincerely that they are doing the best for food safety. They're protecting people, whether they want to be protected or not.
What about the interests of conventional supermarket? Don't you think they would be a little bit frightened by the prospect of people wanting to buy from Farmer Dan?
Yes, and they are frightened. There's no question about it. The conventional dairy industry is frightened about it. I mean, you can just see that from all the statements they've been making. Worrying about this, the way they express worry is they say that if raw milk gets people sick, why, that reflects badly on the entire dairy industry, which just doesn't make any sense, because if raw milk were to get people sick, people would be more inclined to buy pasteurized milk because they'd want the safe alternative. But so what's happening here, I think, from the point of view of the FDA and big dairy and other food interests, is that this whole business of buying locally produced milk and other foods direct from farmers is getting out of hand. It's just getting away from them.
Well, I don't know about you, but I wouldn't mind buying Farmer Dan's milk, his chickens, and whatnot. And I can see how 1,000 people in Washington, D.C. would want to buy his produce as well. I can remember, as a matter of fact, visiting Joel Salatin in the Shenandoah River Valley and watching in amazement as people drove for like 3 hours to buy his chickens. And I asked one lady, you know, did you really drive all that way to buy a chicken? And she said, these aren't chickens. These are Joel Salatin chickens.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess there's a little bit of that with Farmer Dan in Pennsylvania as well. And thus the threat to the conventional supermarket. When people start buying directly from farmers, then there it is a threat. So do you see the hand of big business behind this effort to restrict farmer-to-consumer sales?
Well, I see the hand of big business in the actions of the federal regulators who really have the big business interests at heart. If you look at this investigation of Dan Alger, the court action against him in Pennsylvania resulted from an undercover operation by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration in which it had number of agents pose as consumers under assumed names to join this food club in Maryland and buy raw milk from Dan Alger. But they did this for over a year. They posed as members of this food club. The food that Dan delivers is only made available privately. You have to be a member of the club. You pick up your food at the homes of other members. It's you have drop-off right. points. It's not ever made publicly available. You don't go to the local, you know, to a local store or anything to pick it up. And so these agents were going into people's homes and picking up their milk. And I just kind of wonder what you know, anytime government agents come and wander around freely in an individual's garage or on their, you know, on their property, what else are they up to? And I just, because for that kind of operation to be going on for that long, just says to me that this was a very, very serious matter. It had to be approved by the Justice Department. Yep. Justice Department eventually filed the
from the
production.
Heights of government. Well, we're out of time. David Gumpert, author of Raw Milk Revolution. See any sanity coming down the line?
No, I don't, I'm afraid to say. In fact, I see growing amount of insanity.
Now, how to cut that fit? The original is available for download from our webpage at unwelcomeguest.net/559. Now, from one extreme to the other, not looking at large amounts of money wasted to pursue individuals intent on self-sufficiency, looking instead at the result of concentrating more and more of the food system in a rigid profit-driven hierarchy, looking at the sums available to the unscrupulous few who make it their business to manage the system. This is Sea Change Radio.
My guest today on Sea Change Radio is Frederick Kaufman. He's a professor of English at the City University of New York and the school's Graduate School of Journalism. He's a contributing editor, Harper's Magazine, and his recent piece that came out in the July Harper's Magazine is entitled The Food Bubble, How Wall Street Starved Millions and Got Away With It. Welcome to Sea Change Radio, Fred.
Thank you, Alex.
Why don't you first start out telling our listeners a little bit of the genesis of this article, The Food Bubble. You've also written, I should mention, books such as American Stomach, A Short History of the American Stomach, which is a fascinating read I recommend to our listeners. So you've obviously been writing about food in many different ways. This is a little different. This is kind of a confluence of business reporting and food reporting, right?
Yes. I was in Washington, D.C. a couple of years ago attending a conference about the rising prices of food. I don't know, maybe some of your listeners remember that, you know, 2008 you were paying more for a quart of milk or for some chicken or your dozen eggs. The price was actually going through the roof. And there was a conference in Washington, D.C. to try to understand why the prices of grain, why the prices of all the inputs in our for our weekly grocery list were going so high up. And I was listening to these endless speeches, very boring speeches for the most part, about agriculture. And that's one of the problems with this issue is so much of this is so arcane and so bizarre and so inside the beltway in its own way that people, I think, have just kind of given up on understanding how agricultural markets work, the general public. But anyway, there I was listening to this. And between all of the speeches, people would kind of sidle up to me and they say, what are you doing here? And I tell them I was interested in the rising food prices. And they would say, well, you know, I've heard a rumor that the wheat market has been cornered. And as a journalist, that really stopped me short because that is a huge story. And of course, what does it mean to corner a market? This is the classic behavior of Gilded Age monopolists, which is you try to control as much of a single commodity as possible, be it gold or silver or milk or cheese or gasoline, and by holding it and as much as possible driving the price up. And I thought, is somebody actually cornering the market in wheat? And if that were the case, this would definitely be worth a lot of investigation.
And what conclusions did you draw in your piece, The Food Bubble?
Well, I discovered something really odd, which was that the market, the wheat market, was acting as though it were cornered, even though nobody was actually cornering it. And that was the strangest and most counterintuitive finding that I came to, is that for some reason, something had entered the dynamics of this market that was making it act in this bizarre way, driving this bubble and, in effect, subverting and destroying the American wheat market, which, of course, has vast effects on the global wheat market. So let's also talk about what we know happened in 2008 in terms of global wheat and global grain, which was in effect that it went through the roof, that there were food riots in more than 30 countries, riots which left dozens of people dead. In America, too, we saw unprecedented numbers of food insecure. We saw 49 million hungry families in America. We saw 1 in 5 kids in America on food stamps. We saw 1 million hungry people in Los Angeles. There were devastating effects to the rising cost of wheat. And so I was thinking to myself, what is behind this? What is driving this unbelievable bubble in wheat? And so I started investigating the most widely exported form of wheat on the American continent. In other words, the wheat that sets the global price. And what I discovered is that there's not just one wheat. There are a number of wheats. Some traded in Chicago and Chicago Mercantile Exchange. Some traded on the Kansas City Board of Trade. But the most widely exported wheat from the American continent is a form of wheat called Hard Red Spring. And that is traded exclusively on this obscure syndicate out of Minnesota called the Minneapolis Grain Exchange. And so I actually went to Minneapolis and I talked to the CEO of the Grain Exchange and I talked to a lot of people who worked there because something very odd had happened to the price of Hard Red Spring in 2008, which is that Hard Red Spring usually trades for between $3 to $6 per 60-pound bushel. There was a run from about 2005 to 2008 in which the price of Hard Red Spring doubled, and then it doubled again, and then it doubled again. It hit $12, $15, it topped $20. And finally, on February 25th, 2008, the price of a Hard Red Spring wheat future ended the day at over $25 per bushel, more than about 10 times its normal price. And this sent world markets into a tizzy. This had devastating effects.
So there's many different types of wheat and this Hard Red Spring that all of a sudden shot up. Can you walk us back a little bit to the history of wheat production worldwide?
Yeah, I think one of the most important elements of wheat production worldwide is the stabilization of the price of wheat. Because wheat is a real thing. It grows out of the ground. And so therefore, when people bring their wheat to the market, when farmers bring their wheat to the market, as it turns out, they all kind of bring it around the same time, just as all the rice growers in Japan used to bring their rice to the market at the same time, and the wheat and the corn, it grows and it's ready, it comes to the market. What happens when tons, millions of tons of wheat all hit the market at the same time is the price plummets. It just goes right down in classic supply and demand fashion. When there's an overabundance of supply, when it's going to last you the whole year, then the price goes down. And then, of course, later on in the year, as the supply dwindles, the price shoots up. Well, this is no good. It is no good because we need wheat all year round. We need it every day. And it's not just a matter of you and I, Alex, and people who buy the bread, but it's the manufacturers of the bread. There are very large capitalist interests who have a very big stake in a stable price of wheat. We're talking about Cargill. We're talking about Sara Lee and Domino's Pizza. People who have very large stakes in wheat markets and need to manage their risks and price that wheat 9-10 months in advance. Okay? So that's the basis for the need to stabilize the price. And one of the most brilliant things about the development of the American futures markets and grain is that they have allowed that price of wheat to go on a general downward arc since 1903. Since 1903, for more than 100 years, the price of wheat, the real price of wheat, has steadily gone down. And this has been a great thing for our country. This is part of what made the 20th century the American century, is that the wheat price was stable, people could afford food, food was relatively cheap, and the dollar is relatively strong. Okay? This is a wonderful thing, and it allows for all sorts of economic development. Well, how did this happen? How do these markets work? Well, I'm not going to go into brain-numbing detail here, but the bottom line is that there are two kinds traditionally in the wheat markets. There are two kinds of participants. One are called the bona fide hedgers. Those are the people who actually have a stake in wheat, who actually create wheat like farmers, or store wheat like the warehousemen, or they buy wheat like, once again, Sara Lee or Domino's Pizza. And those people need to buy and sell their wheat on these markets, and they benefit from a stable price. On the other hand, there are speculators in this market. Now, a lot of people think, oh, the speculators were to blame. Speculators are not necessarily a bad thing. Speculators are people who want to make money on the day-to-day rise and fall of the price of wheat. So in other words, what they're doing is when they see the price is being a little bit low, they buy. And then as it rises, they sell. That's it. And those speculators are welcome to the market because they traditionally are said to provide liquidity to the market. So because the speculators are buying and selling wheat, that allows the bona fide hedgers to sell and buy as much wheat as they want whenever they want. The key to both of these participants in the market is that they have to take sell positions for every buy and buy positions for every sell. That's the beauty of the futures market. What a futures contract is simply a promise to either buy or to sell wheat at some point in the future.
I was surprised to learn in your piece, the commodities market had traditionally been a very stable one and not a volatile one. So why don't you tell us a little bit how this new form of trading, this was in the 90s, so everybody's trading volatility, the delta. That was not the case for most of the 20th century in the commodities markets, right? Can you tell us how that evolved and some people may say devolved?
Well, people make money, brokers make money when the price of a commodity or of anything fluctuates, when it goes up, when it goes down, when it does so erratically. Some people are going to make money and some people are going to lose money. And generally, it's the professionals who make the money and are able to anticipate the movements of the market. That's the idea of trading volatility. Of course, there's slight changes in wheat markets all the time, and this is what allows speculators to stay in the business. However, the grand arc of these futures contracts have generally been stable for about 100 years. Now, by the 90s, a lot of the international commodity traders were actually getting out of these markets. They found that they were not making enough money on these markets. They found that there wasn't enough movement in these markets. This was around the time that Goldman Sachs came up with the Commodity Index Fund, the Goldman Sachs Commodity Index Fund. And what it was the idea of a mathematical formula like any index, such as the Dow Jones or the S&P 500. It was an index of the prices of a number of commodities, some of them in energy, some of them in livestock, and some of them in agriculture. And so what they came up with was a mathematical formula so that you can invest in one number and stick your money in that one number and watch your money grow.
But these futures, I thought that just similar to stocks, you need to find, in terms of the futures markets, you need to find a buyer for every seller. So for every short position, there needs to be a comparable long position, correct? But in this case, we found that we're skipping ahead a little bit, but the markets, everyone started going long on this, which is one of the...
Okay, the conventional wisdom of futures markets and all the financial professionals I talk to and all the traders I talk to, one of their great dogmas is for every short, there's a long, for every long, there's a short. And this short and long, this is all, sometimes this is confusing to people. It's very simple. When you go short, you say, I'm going short, that's simply a promise to sell wheat at some future date. And when you go long, that simply means you're promising to buy wheat at a future date. So in other words, for every sell promise, there's a promise to buy. For every short, there's a long, and a long, there's a short. And that's why these things cancel each other out five times a year. And that's why what Goldman Sachs came up with in 1991 was so radically different. Because a commodity index fund, well, the idea was to allow a different kind of investor to enter this market. Not a speculator and not a bona fide hedger, but a very deep-pocketed investor. We're talking about hedge funds, we're talking about state pension funds, and we are also talking about sovereign wealth funds. In other words, huge pockets of capital looking for a place to sit for a long period of time, maybe 15-year window, maybe 20-year window. And they could sit that money in the Goldman Sachs Commodity Index and supposedly, over the years, watch that index go up. There's only one problem. As that index goes up, what that means is the price of food is going up. And so their investment is actually making our daily bread less and less affordable. That, of course, didn't necessarily occur to the people at Goldman because that was not their focus. Their interest is not actually in the commodity market, they have different interests. Their interests are making money for themselves. And this commodity index fund turned out to be a great way, not only for Goldman Sachs, but for all the banks that imitated them to make a lot of money. And in fact, everybody likes to talk about Goldman Sachs as a villain, but this was JP Morgan Chase. This was Lehman Brothers. This was AIG. Everybody out there realizing there is money to be made in commodity index funds, forgetting that these funds and the rising value of it would have a devastating effect on real people throughout the world.
As the bubble started to burst in 2008, you say, quote, the ranks of the hungry had increased by 250 million in a single year, the most abysmal increase in all of human history. So how did we get to that point?
The key here is that whenever you talk to people about commodities, they'll say, well, I know why there was a food bubble in 2008. It's biofuels. In other words, it's the federally mandated acreage for corn that put a real crimp in the wheat acreage and sent the price up. Or other people will tell you, no, it was the drought in Australia. And other people will say, oh, in fact, it was the flooding in Kazakhstan. And all of these things contributed to a problem with the supply of wheat. However, the wheat harvest of 2008 was the greatest wheat harvest in world history. There has never been a year where there has been more wheat harvested in the world. Now, that does not mean there was a perception. There was a perception of a problem in the supply lines. But added to that perception was this unbelievable and unprecedented interference in the basic guts of how this market was working. And that was done by these large banking conglomerates. And this is the interference. This is what happened, is that, as I was explaining, for every buy, there's supposed to be a sell. Well, what Goldman did, and everybody followed, is that they would take these long positions in the wheat market. In other words, they'd say, okay, we're going to promise to buy a lot of wheat when this contract is up. Today, there are second and third generation commodity index funds which take into account the short side of things. But at the beginning, the idea was, if we want to collect and amass a huge pool of capital, the best way to do it is to go long only. That way, we can simply collect money, put it into one particular kind of position on these markets, and then continue to grow that position, to make that position larger and larger and larger as time goes on. So in fact, five times a year, whenever those contracts would come up, which would be the time, logical time, for these large banking entities to sell, they wouldn't sell. What they would do is they would take all that stuff that they were holding, all those long promises to buy, and they would do something called roll it over. They would do a rollover. So they would just say, okay, we're not going to buy it now. We'll buy it in the next contract. And they'd roll their position over. Plus, at the same time, since they had more money pouring in, they would buy a lot more of these promises to buy. And so they collected, they amassed this huge, unprecedented collection of promises to buy. And it actually began to unsteady the market, so that actually, at a certain time, these positions, these long-only promises to buy, there are more of these made by banks and speculators than there were than there was actual wheat in the market. In other words, they overpowered the actual amount of wheat, and they overpowered the number of actual and bona fide hedgers in the market. There's one more step which is really essential here, and that's really understanding how reprehensible the bankers acted in this case. Because while they were actively destroying and setting out of whack these markets, guess what? They had protected their positions outside those markets through this really diabolical process called replication. People don't understand how the bankers do their business. So let's say, Alex, you give me $100 to invest in a commodity index fund, right? Because you want to get in on this commodity bubble and make some money, right? Because the price of wheat's going up 84%. Isn't that great? So you give me $100. Fred, invest this for me. Well, what should I do? What I should do is I should take that $100 and invest that in commodity index funds. But I don't have to. All I really need to do is take 5% as a good faith deposit, and that will hold that $100 position on the commodity market, such as in Chicago or in Kansas City. So really all I've done, Alex, you give me $100, but I've put down 5. So now I'm holding 95 of your dollars. So Imagine if instead of $100, it's $100 million or $100 billion, $317 billion. So what do they do with 95% of that money? Well, no fools they. They put it in the most conservative investment possible. They sink most of it in United States Treasury bills. Okay, so now they have all of this money, hundreds of billion dollars in T-bills. Well, once you have a lot of money in T-bills, what can you
leverage
do with it?
Leverage it.
Well, yeah, you got it. You leverage that hundreds of billions into trillions, and then you take those trillions of dollars and you give it to your day traders, your brilliant mathematical day traders, and you say, guys, take the most lucrative investment, take the most lucrative positions you can do day by day, hour by hour, and make us a lot of money. It was extraordinary how much money they made on the backs of a billion starving people. I mean, this is serious what happened. The numbers of people on the earth for the first time in 2008, not only the percentages, but the real numbers of hungry people ratcheted up in unison. And for the first time in world history, we had more than a billion people on earth in a position of food insecurity, the most abysmal figure in the history, in human history. And that is what allowed the bankers to make billions of dollars. Simple, straightforward human suffering. What happened in 2008 is that there were so many losses in so many other parts of the economy that people actually had to take out money from commodity index funds to cover losses in other parts of their business. At the same time, they came to realize that, in fact, because of this constant counterintuitive buying into strength, that when they actually looked at how much money they had made, that they hadn't made very much. In fact, a lot of these commodity index funds had made a tremendous amount of money for the banks that were offering them through management fees, through replication. But the people who were actually putting their money in them lost money.
The comparisons to the subprime mess that we're still feeling the reverberations from are pretty stark.
Well, we're going to feel, let me tell you something, Alex, we are going to feel reverberations from this food bubble that are even starker. Because guess what? We are seeing food volatility today. We have yet to really see the effects of the flooding in Pakistan. It looks as though they probably are not going to get their crops in. The drought in Russia, the fires in Russia, the export bans in Russia, these are going to be huge factors. And this is why the UN has called for their special meeting on the 24th of September to discuss specifically global speculation in commodities and global supply, because this is really just the beginning of what could be tough going in the future in these major commodity markets, particularly food markets.
Fred, what are some of the solutions to this problem that you highlight so well in your piece, The Food Bubble, in Harper's Magazine in July?
Well, I think that when we see the Food and Agriculture Organization of the UN meet on September 24th, I think that one of the big issues is going to be this push towards free-flowing and liquid globalized grain markets. In other words, no more import-export bans like we're seeing in Russia right now. Free flow, no more side deals. I just saw today that Russia had made a side deal with Kazakhstan to import like 500 million bushels, this sort of thing. The only valid solution has got to be the International Grain Reserve. It's got to be, and it can be a farmer-owned reserve, it's got to be real wheat stepping in when you have these this price volatility. And we're going to see a lot more price volatility going forward. I don't think there's any question that with the drought flood cycles that we see based on what is now a fairly obvious climate change situation, we're going to be seeing a real variety in wheat harvests, particularly in the area around the Baltic Sea, which is becoming an increasingly important wheat growing area. But traditionally, those harvests are erratic. And so we're going to need to really fight very hard to figure out what are new stabilizing forces and to bring all those stabilizing forces to bear. Now that the futures markets have been hijacked and could easily be hijacked again. I mean, the futures, global futures markets used to be this great stabilizing force. Now they've been hijacked. So we have to try to get back to and use any other kind of stabilizing force possible. And it's very hard to keep Wall Street out of the food business. Because when I talk to, for instance, some of the bankers, I say, what if people just disallow you and they make a law? The federal government says no more bankers in the food business. They laugh at this. They literally scoff at the ideas of regulators getting them out of this business. Because all they really then have to do is put in a call to their London office and do their trades out of there. Not illegal in London. They're multinational.
Right. So we can't simply just say, well, this is the Clinton administration's fault, and maybe it was at the time, but the cat is out of the bag, and these entities are global, and one country making a change to, let's say, restoring the Glass-Steagall Act, et cetera, that's not actually going to put these cats back in their bag, so to speak, correct?
Cargill does business in hundreds of countries. They do business in hundreds of countries. I mean, forget about their tax problems. Who's going to regulate them? How can we regulate a company like this? And, of course, food is increasingly this globalized international phenomena with China making land grabs in Africa, and it's totally interrelated. The markets and the futures markets are completely interrelated. You cannot buy and sell real or fictional wheat anywhere in the world without having an effect on real or fictional wheat everywhere in the world. And so, once again, we have to get back to the real.
What could the SEC have done back in 91 when the Goldman Sachs Commodity Index was first being traded to try to stymie this food bubble?
The CFTC, the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, never should have granted exemptions to Wall Street banks, which was done in the mid-90s. That just should not have happened. That was an outrage.
And as we've seen in the last 8 years, having EPA people from coal and oil extraction companies, a lot of these people who are running these government organizations are coming from the industry. So a lot of these scenarios are kind of the fox guarding the hen house, so to speak, right?
If you look at the people at the Minneapolis Grain Exchange, if you look at the chairman of the board, you will find a high-ranking executive from Cargill. And in fact, just last year, the Minneapolis Grain Exchange went private. These guys are going to make a lot of money for themselves due to the regulations, due to the federal mandates that all trades be relegated to exchanges. Places like the Minneapolis Grain Exchange, these obscure syndicates, will all of a sudden find themselves the beneficiaries of being the place and the clearinghouse, not for 10 or 20 new exchange-traded funds. But they have just retrofitted their entire operation, so they're able to handle 50,000 exchange-traded funds. That's the future, Alex.
Great analysis there, but is that really the future, or is that the direction that a few psychopaths would like to take society in? I have long thought it completely unacceptable that some people literally starve while others have far too much food, and I've done my best not to accept it. I think as these disparities become ever greater, resistance and alternative ways of doing things, yes, alternative ways of doing even money, and I'm expecting just about the time when ordinary people can't use dollars anymore to pay the landlord or do other ordinary things, about that time, person-to-person currencies, which emphasize personal relationship and a history of mutual gifts, will take over, leaving a few people with some bits of paper that claim they have a right to pretty much everything in the world, and a lot of ordinary people saying, yeah, you play your game and we'll play ours. And now our last speaker, it's Patrick Holden speaking at the Ealing Transition Town Initiative. And this is from a website entitled Planetary Voices, planetaryvoices.org.uk.
I'm with Patrick Holden, director of the Soil Association. Patrick, what exactly is the Soil Association?
Well, it's actually a membership organisation founded in 1946 by a very far-sighted lady who was a farmer, Eve Balfour, niece of Prime Minister Balfour, a Tory Prime Minister, who realised that there was a fundamentally important connection between soil, food and health, but the public were largely ignorant about the importance of that connection. And so she said, what we need to do is to set up an organisation to promote better public understanding of this vital link, because she argued that soil looked after sustainably, and that means returning waste, composting, all the things that, you know, organic gardeners know about today, will give rise to healthy plants. And then, of course, on a farming scale, the plants feed the animals and the animals feed the people, and the plants and the animals feed the people. And this soil food health connection has been forgotten for actually half a century. And instead, we've industrialized our farming, we've replaced good husbandry with artificial fertilizers and chemicals, and we've degraded our food. And during that same period, interestingly enough, there's been the rise and rise of all the environmental charities, which now 5 million people belong to. But we've forgotten the importance of food. And our food systems and our farming give rise not to only to our own health, but the health of the environment, the welfare of the animals, and in fact, the well-being of the population as a whole. And Lady Eve's far-sightedness was a sort of voice in the wilderness then. Today, we have 23,000 members, and I hope we're going to do something to change that now, because I believe food security is going to become one of the great issues of the 21st century.
And what is the main work that the association does nowadays?
Well, we have our members, I just mentioned them. We are well known for certifying organic food, so when you look for organic food, very often it'll have our little symbol on it. But for me, the most important work we do is promoting a public awareness of the importance of food and healthy food and good food farming practice. And what we want to do is to enable people who are concerned about food and health and food security and being more sustainable to learn more and do more from the ground up. Because I think this is one of those moments in history when the change needs to happen from what I can do. We can no longer afford to leave it to politicians to take action, because it might be too late. And we've seen that with Copenhagen recently, haven't we?
Organic food has caught on more in the last few years, though, hasn't it?
It has, but it's not been immune to the effect of the recession, interestingly enough. The market for organic foods grew by at least 10% every year for about 15 years. And then in the last year, it's gone down by about 10 to 14%. And that's because people have traded down, as they say. They've, you know, say, gone to free range from organic or that sort of thing because of, obviously, the effects of the squeeze on their incomes. But as a nation, I think we've never attached a sufficiently high priority on food, and we've been rather obsessed with price rather than quality. And I think, really, that needs to change. I mean, it's interesting that we spend less than 10% of our disposable income on food today. And back in the 70s, it was nearly 30%.
So tell us, Patrick, why you think organic is best.
Well, it's a system of food production which works with the grain of nature, building fertility through crop rotation, avoiding the use of chemical fertilizers, which degrade the nutritional integrity of food, and, of course, pesticides, which threaten our health and that of the environment, and avoids harmful greenhouse gas emissions and overuse of non-renewable external inputs such as fossil fuels. So really, it's a sustainable system of food production which is good for us and for the environment.
Tell us a bit about the theme of your talk last week in Ealing.
Well, I'm a Londoner. I come from, well, various bits of London, Dulwich, Peckham, Barnet. So I'm an urban dweller who had a dream back in the 70s that I wanted to be a, you know, rural food producer. And I put that dream into practice on my farm in West Wales. But somehow when you grow up in a place, you're always rooted to it in a way. So I'm particularly interested in food and the question of how London, and Ealing in particular, can source its food in a sustainable way. Because I think that there is a real issue about the precariousness and security of our food supplies. I mean, we all go down to the supermarket and we stock up from the shelves and they seem bountiful and never-ending. But if we stop for a moment and think about the fragility of that chain which takes the food back to where it was grown and ask ourselves, do we know who produced the food? Do we know which country it came from? What would happen if there was a sudden external shock? Let's say a weather event, we've had one of those recently, or if you think of the recent earthquake and the effect that it had on the food systems there, which is very interesting, or terrorism or a military conflict or something like that, or simply a strike. And then you think of all the food, which is globally sourced and processed in single central point distribution places and then distributed through to supermarkets. And if that system ground to a halt, how long would it be before we went hungry? How self-sufficient, how resilient is Ealing? How much can it rely on its own food resources if there was an external crisis? And I think the painful truth is hardly at all. You know, and within 7 days, you know, people talk about nine meals from anarchy. And the last time we had a sort of external shock and food security was a big issue was, of course, during the Second World War. And then we had the U-boats sinking the North Atlantic convoys and food security was a big issue. And we all dug for victory, kept hens, and relied on that lattice work of small local producers that surrounded every town and city in England and in Britain. And since the Second World War, we've industrialized and centralized our food systems to a frightening degree, so much so that we now have no resilience against those sorts of external shocks. And I think we need to think about that, because after all, our chief scientist, Sir David King, who gave a lecture in London last week, which was reported on the food programme, is talking about a global food crisis where there simply won't be enough to feed the expanding population. And in those circumstances, the capacity of a nation like Britain, which of course has more people than we have acres to feed it, to look after itself in a crisis is an issue. So I'm interested in how, if you buy into what I've just said, a citizen of Ealing could think about this and say, well, what can I do to be the change? You know, what can I do in my garden, in my local community, maybe working with others in schools, in the way I buy my food? How can I exercise my citizen power to enable a more secure food supply system for Ealing in the future?
What do you think some of the answers might be to this question? Do you think it's about having allotment spaces, growing your own in your back garden, looking for farm shops locally?
All of the above, absolutely. The first action really is to grow some of my own food. And there's such a joy in doing that, you know, to reconnect with nature and to taste food which you produced yourself and it's so fresh and everything. And it is part of the solution, because it's surprising on even a very small plot of land how much food you can produce. I mean, in my garden in Bristol, I've got a purple sprouting broccoli plantation which seems to have come through the frost quite well. And I'm relishing the prospect of, you know, 3 months of purple sprouting broccoli for almost every meal come probably actually early March. It's surprising when it starts to come, and if I pick it vigorously enough, it'll go right till June. I've got a bit of rhubarb actually on the railway embankment, courtesy of Network Rail, or I call it a sort of informal share farming agreement with Network Rail, so informal they don't know about it. So I'm growing a bit of soft fruit on the railway embankment, and I think many of us can grow some of our fresh vegetables and fruit in our gardens or very locally in allotments. But then, of course, some of the stuff we can't produce. And then I think it's about building relationships with producers that we know and that they are there for us and we're there for them. And that's a new kind of relationship. Some people call it community-supported agriculture. I think it comes in a range of shapes and sizes, but it's about new partnerships between people in the community and the producers upon whom they depend and, of course, who in turn depend on them.
I read a statistic that 30% of climate change footprint comes from food. That's quite significant, isn't it?
It is. It's probably about the largest single element of emissions of anything we do. And as important, perhaps more important than that, it's the one in which we have most control to change. And so if we're serious about addressing climate change, food is the first place to start. But it isn't just climate change, it's fossil fuel depletion and it's food security. So there are three good reasons there alone, quite apart from your own health and the wider implications of changing a relationship with your food, which are good reason to act.
Can you tell us a little bit more about community-supported agriculture?
Well, the classic form of community-supported agriculture is a farmer who wants to make a contractual relationship with customers, families, individuals who say to the farmer, I'll give you X pounds a year and I want a share of your harvest. So let's imagine you're a farmer and you had 200 customers and they all said, okay, we'll give you £500 a year, £100 a year, whatever the share, agreed share was. Then the farmer would produce for that family or that buyer throughout the year, and that person would know that they had the security of knowledge that the farmer's growing food specifically for them. So, I mean, they might be a vegetable producer or a beef producer. They might have a freezer pack of meat a couple of times a year, or it might be a cheese producer, as I am, or my son is now. Could be all sorts of different kinds of food production. But essentially, most farmers now have one customer, you know, a supermarket or a buyer who supplies a supermarket. That's not very secure, either for the final customer or for the producer. This idea is you form a direct link with the producer. You're there for them. They're there for you. That's food security made flesh. It's a relationship. And it's also life-enhancing because you can go and visit the farm and, you know, enjoy maybe even a bit of work on the farm. But there are other forms of community-supported agriculture. Some farmers and growers operate box schemes. They're very well known these days. And then, of course, you could buy directly from the farm shop. And that's, in a way, a form of community-supported agriculture. But I think there are more that could emerge. And this is about the sort of creative ingenuity of Ealing. You could adopt a farm somewhere, you know, in the agricultural hinterland of London. You could find a farmer who'd like to change the way he or she grows their food and say, well, why don't you grow for us? Might be a community of people.
Tell us a little bit about certification of organic food, Patrick, because there are specific organic standards and, you know, are people getting genuine organic products when they go to the stores?
They are. The rationale for certification was for people who buy food from someone they don't know, which of course is most of the food that we buy today, you want to know that it's produced to a certain set of standards. And as one of the early adopters, as it were, I was farming sustainably back in the early 70s, and we were having a hard time because the Common Agricultural Policy was subsidising every litre of milk and every tonne of grain, and the more you produced, the more you got. And of course, we weren't using fertilisers, so we were producing a bit less of high quality, but we were having to sell it on the conventional market. So we thought, well, why don't we write down what we're doing, more or less on the back of an envelope, as it was in those days, and take our message to the customer. And that became one of the early drafts of the livestock standards. So really, what you're looking at here is a prescription for sustainable agriculture, which is then inspected by, in our case, the Soil Association inspector. So as an organic farmer who's Soil Association certified, we have a Soil Association inspector who visits the farm once a year, and he or she goes around the farm and checks our records and looks at the fields and makes sure we haven't done anything we shouldn't have done, and compiles a report, sends it back to the head office, they check it over, and then if we pass and we have no non-compliances, as it's known, then we are certified for the next year. And so, you know, if you buy our cheese, as it would be in my case, or carrots, as it used to be, because we also used to be carrot producers, that it is produced sustainably and you can trust it. And that certification system is now operating all over the world. Now, if you know the farmer or grower you're buying from, perhaps you don't need them to be certified. So it really is a mechanism to build trust in traded food.
I'm with Patrick Holden from the Soil Association. Where are we at the moment on genetically modified crops?
That is a really interesting question. Back at the end of the 90s, the Soil Association took a principled stand against genetic engineering. But since then, unfortunately, Monsanto and other companies have obtained a sort of vice-like grip over control of genetically engineered seeds. And they've persuaded a whole generation of farmers to change from the seeds that they used to use, which they could save and were self-pollinating and you could use year after year, to Monsanto Roundup Ready seeds of corn and soya and oilseed rape and now possibly lucerne or alfalfa, as it's known over there. And as a result, those three or four commodity crops are dominating the agricultural production of the whole continent. And obviously, that's what the Americans are eating. And it's quite frightening that over a million tons of genetically engineered maize and soya is imported into this country every year and fed to pigs and poultry and some to cattle. So we're getting it ourselves through the back door, and we have absolutely no idea what the long-term effect of that is, because no proper feeding trials have ever been done. There are also environmental effects, because this genetically engineered resistance to sprays such as Roundup gets transferred to weed populations, and the narrowing of the gene pool. You know, we used to grow 1,000 varieties of maize, and now there's just one. And I think that's dangerous in its own right. So I would say it is an unfolding catastrophe. And there, but for the grace of God and certain campaigning organisations, of which the Soil Association is one, goes the UK and the rest of Europe. And we haven't by any means won the battle yet.
What about the growing of GM foods here? Do you think we'll see it eventually?
I hope not, because we haven't given up on our campaign. We believe it is essential to stop commercial planting in this country, and we won't give up.
Tell us about this new film that's out called Food Inc.
It is an amazing film, which I'd recommend everybody to go and see, or eventually when it comes out, buy a DVD. It's about the grip that a handful of corporate multinational companies have got on our food systems, including genetically engineered seeds, as I just said. But it goes further than that, because these companies, they not only own the seeds, but also they often trade in the commodity crops. And then if you go further down the food chain, they process the foods into meat products and many other products. And then, of course, the retailers, the major supermarkets, particularly the multinational supermarkets, are the final link in the control chain. And really what those commercial interests have done has, I think, robbed us of our food security and our right to good quality food with a good story behind it. And there's something insidious about this, the way this has happened, and that's what Food Inc. exposes, and really quite frightening. And it's quite US-focused, so it's talking to American farmers and about American companies and the effect on American consumers. But the interesting thing is that almost every one of the issues the film raises has its UK counterpart. And when the film is launched, in fact, the premiere is going to be on the 8th of February, Eric Schlosser, who wrote Fast Food Nation, who's one of the narrators, along with another amazing man called Michael Pollan, Eric is coming to London, and he's going to sing for his supper. And I've got the privilege of joining him on a couple of platforms and talking to the people who watch the film, these early showings of the film. It's been a real storming success in the US, and I hope it will be here as well.
Patrick, tell us a little bit about Food for Life partnership.
Well, it's all because of an extraordinary dinner lady called Jeanette Ory that the Food for Life partnership and program came about. Jeanette was a dinner lady in a primary school in Nottinghamshire, and she saw that the food that the children were eating was awful, and she wanted to do something about it, so she did. And she started serving freshly prepared ingredients from locally sourced food, and she sourced it organically where possible. And she noticed that the children enjoyed the food more, and their attention was better. And there were other beneficial effects. She got the children starting to visit the farms where the food was produced, and then gave them a contact with nature and a sense of connection with their food for the first time in their lives. And interestingly enough, and then we spotted her and thought that's a powerful idea. So she became the school dinner advisor to the Soil Association. And then we hatched up this program called Food for Life, which is based on a set of standards. 75% of the ingredients freshly prepared in the premises of the school, 50% locally sourced and 30% organic. And then also connecting up the children in the schools to the story behind the food by visiting the farms and then encouraging the teachers to make sense of what they learn on the farms in the curriculum, because there's an awful lot of biology and geography and all sorts of things, you know, that you can learn when you go and visit a farm. And to cut a very long story short, along the road, Jamie Oliver met Jeanette and came across our Food for Life program and thought, I might make a program or a series of programs about that, and the rest is history. Not widely known that actually Jamie got his original idea from the Soil Association's Food for Life program, but he did. And we then, after Jamie's school dinners, which of course really turned the whole thing into a national campaign, we got a big lottery grant to roll out the Food for Life program in 3,600 English schools, primary and secondary. And I would say it really is changing the culture of a whole generation of school children, which is terribly exciting. And we've recently launched a Food for Life catering mark, which is basically applying the same standards to restaurants and other food caterers, hospitals, cafes. And that actually is brilliant because it means that anybody who signs up for the Food for Life catering mark, they're contractually obliged to source local, fresh and organic food to in the ratios I described, which of course is very good for local farmers. So it's a real change agent, as they say.
How do you see the further transformation of food and farming in the future?
I think it's got to come from the ground up, as I said earlier. I think this old idea that the government can do everything and corporations can do things is outdated now. We can't rely on them acting soon enough to avoid a major food crisis. So we have to be the change, and our individual action counts. We're like cells in a vast organism which constitutes the whole of humanity, and each cell matters. And interestingly enough, sort of these ideas, I think, spread in some sort of viral way between individuals.
And for people who might think a bit sceptically, I don't know whether organic really makes a difference, where would they start?
I mean, do grow something. Our president is Monty Don, and I was actually with him last night because he came down to the Soil Association offices to have a chat about how he could help us the next year. And he's a great man for believing in, you know, growing food yourself. And I think that's actually where it all starts. But obviously you're not growing all your food unless you're an exceptional human being and you're concentrating on that to an extraordinary degree. So when you buy food, if you have not been buying organic food and local food, choose a couple of staples that you could buy locally and organically and start there. You know, could be potatoes, could be carrots, could be meat if you're a meat eater. Buy food from a local producer whose story you know and support the change and also enhance your own health in the process.
And will people taste the difference?
Absolutely. More trace elements and minerals, better for you, life-enhancing, and increases your quality of life. And the Soil Association is all about enabling that process. So what we hope we'll do over the coming years is build a big membership of people who actually want to go on that journey of change and build a new food culture in this country.
Patrick Holden, Director of the Soil Association.
This and all previous episodes of Unwelcome Guests are available for download as MP3s from unwelcomeguests.net/archive. There's a mailing list at altruists.org/unwelcome for any discussion relevant to the show. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening. Keep giving all you can. Now, I've thought of something that I can give you, which is fresh seeds from tropical fruit trees, because I like to eat a lot of fruit here. Now, it's not going to work if you live in Europe or the US, but if you're listening on the internet and you live in tropical country and you're interested in fresh seeds of fruit trees, give me an email and see if we can work something out.